from the Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our special guest this week, Joseph Ellis, is among the most highly acclaimed biographers of our founding fathers. His book, American Sphinx, The Character of Thomas Jefferson, won the National Book Award in Nonfiction, and he won a Pulitzer Prize for his founding brothers. Joseph Ellis joins us today to discuss his latest book, His Excellency George Washington. After that, Thomas Fleming will provide us with some historical insight into one of the many myths associated with George Washington, and Fiona Beatty will offer us another lead on where to find out more about our first president. But first, as we do each week, let's look at some items of historical interest in the news that you may have missed on George Washington. If you had $21.3 million to spare, you might have purchased a portrait of George Washington. That portrait, Charles Wilson Peale's George Washington at Princeton, the battle, not the university, was sold recently for that amount at Christie's Auction House in New York City. It was a world record for the sale of an American portrait, another first for the first president. The full-length portrait is signed and dated 1779 by the Revolutionary period's premier portrait artist and is one of eight portraits of Washington painted by Peale between 1779 and 1781. If you can't afford such a portrait of your own, you might visit Mount Vernon, where scientists have created what they consider to be the most accurate depictions of George Washington at three critical stages in his life: age 19 as a young surveyor, age 45 as commander of the Continental Army, and at 57 when he became president. After almost 2 years of forensic research, historical delving, computer manipulation, and artistic work, the three sculptures have been put on public display at the president's home. And James Loewen is out to set the record straight again. You may recall that Loewen has been our guest on Talking History on a couple of occasions, including a conversation on his book Lies Across America, wherein he corrects some of the liberties taken with history at various historical sites and monuments. On his latest list of 10 such sites is the Washington Memorial Chapel at Valley Forge National Park. Its dominant characteristic, Loewen writes, is its two matched sets of dazzling stained glass windows, one depicting the life of Jesus Christ, the other the life of George Washington. The latter includes a scene of Washington kneeling in prayer in the snow at Valley Forge, seeking God's assistance in rescuing his troops, starving and freezing in their winter quarters. The story, told by Parson Weems, is well known and often repeated. The problem, Loewen reminds us, is that it never happened, and the story of starvation and freezing is an exaggeration. Well, in a moment we'll hear more about George Washington from our guest, Joseph Ellis. This is Talking History. I'm very pleased to have with me this week Joseph Ellis, the author of His Excellency George Washington. Some of you longtime listeners to Talking History might recall that Joe Ellis was on our show the week of February 18, 2001, and we discussed his book Founding Brothers, for which he won a Pulitzer Prize. Today we'll be discussing his already highly acclaimed new biography of George Washington. Welcome back, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. I have to start off with the obvious question. With the surge of new books on the Founding Fathers, and maybe it's not a surge, it almost seems to be a continual flow of new books on the Founding Fathers, to which you've contributed many volumes, how would you explain this interest? We just can't seem to satisfy the market.
It's a good question, and I've tried not to think too much about it because I'm one of the major beneficiaries of it, and I'm afraid I might analyze it into non-existence. Part of it is that the papers of these folks are now reaching culmination, started in the middle of the century in many cases, and now you've got a massive material available that didn't exist before. Part of it is, I think, that programs like this one, NPR programs, C-SPAN programs, give authors writing books of this sort a venue that they didn't have before. And part of it is a hunger for political leadership that we don't think we have now. Part of it is a kind of once upon a time, presidents wrote their own speeches and were intellectually impressive. When I was on the book tour for Founding Brothers, the question I got, how come in 2000 we have to choose between Gore and Bush, and in the year 1800 we got to choose between Adams and Jefferson? So there's this sense that the political culture we've created up here in the 20th and 21st century isn't delivering the same quality of character that it once did.
And do you think that's fair? Can we look at...
It's not really fair, because being present at the creation confers a huge advantage. That said, I do think that looking back at that generation of political leaders, which I think is the most impressive group of political leaders we've ever had, it does cause you to wonder if there's any way for us to make some changes in the way we elect people and the way we restrict or don't restrict campaigns and campaign finances. It makes you think that there is talent out there in the American society that ought to rise to the top in public life.
Okay. So why George Washington, other than you hadn't done him yet?
Good question. I sort of walked around him a lot, you know, I mean, in other books. And he's like, as I said in the book, he's like the man in the moon. He's always there, but, you know, he's far away. I think he's the toughest nut to crack. I think that he's tougher to write about than Jefferson or Adams, especially. His diaries are not revealing. They're about the weather. And when he talks about which way the wind is blowing, he's not being metaphorical. Yet he is a central figure in American history. I would say he's the most famous figure in American history about whom most educated Americans know almost nothing. I mean, they did a survey at Mount Vernon, and high school kids, only 1 out of 10 knew that George Washington was a Revolutionary War hero.
How much of that comes from our seeming desire to have these people be perfect? And maybe the less we know, the more saintly they become.
I believe you're right on that. And one of the distinguishing features, I think, of my own work is I'm writing about flawed founders. I think that there's kind of an electromagnetic field around the founders, and they carry it to one extreme or the other. They're the greatest figures and heroes of all time, iconographic kind of creatures, or they're the deadest, whitest males in American history, responsible for classism, imperialism, patriarchy, racism, and everything else. I think those are juvenile attitudes. I think we want to get a more adult, mature look at these people who are hardly perfect, but taken together, nevertheless, are the greatest collection of political leaders we've ever had.
Right, and that's the great strength of your book. You really do peel away the myth and get at the man. But let me take you to an early stage in his life. You write in your book that you felt the French and Indian War was an important moment in his life in shaping his personality.
Right, when Adams goes to Harvard and Jefferson goes to William and Mary, Washington goes to war. War is his education, his curriculum. And he learns some hard lessons. I mean, he becomes a hard-boiled realist. Any sentimental emotions he might have had are sort of weaned away from him. You know, he really does survive several battles that, by all rights, he shouldn't have. There's a sense of destiny about him, even as a young man. And people start writing about him in that regard. It's the crucible in which the foundation of his personality takes shape, I think. Not that it's complete. You know, he grows and changes. And it's one of the interesting and impressive things about him. He learns from his experience. But I think that the emotional foundation for the mature man is laid there in his 20s during the French and Indian War.
Okay. Interesting you use the word crucible, because that's the title of the documentary that's currently showing on the French and Indian War.
It's based on the book by Fred Anderson.
Right.
That's a really good book.
Right, it is. Well, let me take you to the American Revolution, because you make another interesting point there by setting him apart from the others in terms of how he arrived at his decision to seek independence or separation from Great Britain.
Yeah, he doesn't think about the coming of the revolution in the same way that Adams and Jefferson do. They think politically and they think constitutionally. They think in terms of Parliament, in terms of Parliament's right to legislate and tax, or their lack of that right. Washington thinks in more primal terms. First of all, the face of the British Empire for him is his merchant friend in London, William Carey. He thinks he's being cheated by Carey. He's trapped in some kind of, he thinks, conspiracy on the part of Carey. Also, he owns about 50,000 acres west of the Alleghenies, And in the Proclamation of 1763, George III says that all that land is an Indian reservation and nobody can own it out there. You know, he thinks that's his land, and it's been taken away from him by this guy, George III. Washington becomes pretty clear by the late 1760s that he thinks that unless Britain changes its course, we're headed towards war.
Interesting. Well, during the American Revolution, he becomes general, and that obviously piques his reputation. And we tend to look at him as a great military leader. But in fact, as you point out, he lost more battles than he won. But nevertheless, we won. So,
of all the successful generals, he lost more battles. He's just the opposite of Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee won all the battles and lost the war. So did Napoleon, for that matter, until he meets his Waterloo. He's not a good tactician. He's out-generaled by Howe on several occasions. But he eventually has the key insight. It's simple, but in retrospect, only in retrospect. Namely, he doesn't have to win the war. The British have to win the war. And in some sense, Brian, he's leading an insurgency. He's leading an army, but an insurgency. And the occupying power, even though it's a powerful, Britain is the most powerful military nation in the world, it's going to have a very difficult time sustaining control over this larger population and landmass. And he knows that. In the end, we don't win the war. They just give up.
Right. That gets replayed in history several times.
Yes.
You know, one of the good things that I really enjoy about the book here is how you set something up and then you either correct it or pose a different idea. Same thing happens when you get to Valley Forge. You acknowledge it's an important turning point and you handled it well, but then you turn around and say what may have even been more important is this decision to inoculate the entire army against smallpox.
Right. He does that early on. And the casualties in the war on both sides, more people died of smallpox than died in combat. Washington is immune to smallpox. He had it as a young man in Barbados. Now, some people say he was immune to everything. But the decision to inoculate the Continental Army and to insist upon that probably is as big as any other military decision he made.
Along the same line, you talk again a little bit about slavery, and most of us, when we think of slavery and the Founding Fathers, think of Jefferson and his agonizing over his ownership of slaves and whatever. And here's Washington, who's not noted for writing anything at length, especially on slaves, but he frees his slaves.
Right, in his will. He frees his slaves, the ones he owns, at Mount Vernon. There are 319 slaves when Washington's an old man, and it's interesting. Of the 319 slaves, he estimates at any time only 100 of them can work. Others are too young, too old, or too sick. So part of his motive is economic.
Huh.
He's losing money. Part of his motive is his own reputation. There's a lot of Quakers who've been saying to him, this is the one stain, and this is the thing that you need to correct before you die. He cares terribly about posterity. He knows that we'd be sitting here in this studio 200 years later. And that he needed to get this one right. And he thinks slavery's wrong. He thinks slavery's incompatible with the values of the Revolution. It doesn't start out that way, but he changes his mind during the course of the war, under the influence of young guys like Hamilton and Henry Lawrence and Lafayette. And so he grows on this issue. He's just the opposite of Jefferson. Jefferson starts out believing in emancipation, and by the end of his life argues for the spread of slavery into Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Washington starts out as a pretty typical planter, talking about his slaves as livestock, and ends up saying that slavery is incompatible with the values of the Revolution, and I must free my own slaves. He's the only major Virginia public figure to do that.
What was behind his decision to wait until he died?
He's a control freak. He doesn't want to give up what he's acquired, and he's not to the manor born. You know, he's really sort of marries his way into the hierarchy of Virginia society. And there's a law, too, that says that if you free your slaves in Virginia, they have to leave the state within a year. And the slaves at Mount Vernon, too, are intermarried. The dower slaves owned by his wife, Martha, who officially Washington doesn't own, mm-hmm. are intermarried with the other slaves. And so if you free one of them, what happens to the families?
Yeah. It's interesting as we proceed here. Before I started reading this book, I, like many people, if you asked me what Washington thought about much of anything, I probably couldn't have answered, because we never study in the traditional text Washington's thinking about mm-hmm. anything. If anything, we're looking at someone who presides over Adams on one side of the table and Jefferson on the other and tries to make a Solomon-like decision. But once again, I'm surprised here's a man who gave a lot of thought to Native Americans.
Absolutely.
So tell us about that.
Well, you know, as a young man, he encountered Native Americans in their fiercest form, and he respected them. In fact, in several instances, he said, if I was in their situation, I'd be doing the same thing they are, trying to protect their own property. It's not property for them, but their own homes. During the first term of his presidency, Washington devotes more time to the Native American issue than anything else. And he wants to avoid Indian removal. He wants to prevent the elimination of an Indian population east of the Mississippi. He wants to create a series of enclaves and homelands that will be protected by federal law and that will be regarded as foreign countries. He said that the Indian ambassadors that are coming from the Shawnee tribe or the Creek tribe are more important than the ambassadors from Britain and France, because the future of America is out here.
Interesting.
And it fails because the states won't let it happen. And it would also have required a military force to protect them that was unaffordable. But that's what he wanted.
Okay. We don't like to see our heroes as ambitious people. Mm. We tend to like to see them as anything but, who happen to get maybe dragged into or encouraged to get involved in something and they're successful. Yet you make the point that Washington was very ambitious.
Adam said that we always selected Washington because he was always the tallest man in the room, but he was also the most ambitious man in the room. He was very avaricious about land. If you were a squatter that sat on some of his land, he'd sue you to death. He was a man who really wanted power, but he knew how to surrender power. His ability to walk away from power was but he did that because he knew in the end that would make him even more powerful.
Right.
And it did.
Right. Very good. Again, it might come as a surprise to people that Washington was not deified in office, did not leave office on a cloud or as a saint. He had his critics when he left office.
He did. His first term was pretty much a cakewalk and hallelujah. But his second term was riddled with controversy, mostly because of different attitudes towards France and the French Revolution. But there's a magazine called The Aurora that opens fire on Washington in his second term, and Tom Paine actually comes back from France and says that we devoutly pray for Washington's death, imminent death, and he's a traitor to the American Revolution. Washington doesn't understand the party warfare that's breaking out in the middle of the 1790s. He doesn't believe in parties. Nobody really believes in parties.
Right.
Jefferson says, if I must go to heaven in a party, I prefer not to go at all. But they're creating them nonetheless, and it creates a kind of bickering and a kind of combustible infighting that Washington wants to levitate above. He doesn't see himself as the leader of a party, but that's what he's become, the Federalist Party.
Okay. We only have a couple minutes left, so let me ask you to think beyond Washington a bit here, because you have really kind of associated the various founding fathers with characteristics. Franklin, you said, was probably the wisest. Hamilton, the most brilliant. Adams, the best read. Jefferson, the most intellectually sophisticated. But you say all of them would have acknowledged Washington to be their superior. Do you still associate all those characteristics with the founding fathers, and why do they defer to Washington as a leader?
I still do believe it. I began writing the book with that question in mind. Why? In some sense, the whole book is an answer. It's leadership. It's judgment. There are so many things that if he had gotten it wrong, we wouldn't be here. But it is a quality of judgment that is basic and elemental. It's not fine spun. Jefferson's very fine spun.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the decision to go lead the Continental Army against the greatest military power in the world and to bet his life on that commitment, he turns out to be right again. To come out of retirement and chair the Constitutional Convention, thereby legitimizing a meeting, a convention that others were calling a kind of coup d'etat, illegal, illegitimate. And then he shapes the American presidency. If you read the Constitution, it doesn't say very much about what the president can do. It tells us how he can elect him. But the modern presidency is a creation of Washington. So he really is first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. And that last thing is really important, because Americans didn't think of themselves as part of a coherent nation. They thought of themselves as New Englanders or Virginians. And Washington is the one figure who symbolizes the nation, and everybody can agree he is America. He is the United States. Remember, when they talk about the United States back in the 18th century, they didn't say the United States is. They said the United States are.
Right.
And he's the person that makes the plural into a singular.
Great. That's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks for joining us, Joe.
It's a pleasure. My pleasure, Brian.
Good to have you here. And congratulations on your book. I've been speaking with the award-winning author and historian Joseph Ellis, the author of His Excellency George Washington, published by Vintage Books. This is Talking History.
Earlier in the show, I reported on James Lowen's criticism of that part of the story of George Washington at Valley Forge that has him praying in the snow for God's assistance to relieve his men of their starving and freezing. Talking History regular Thomas Fleming joins us at this point to add his perspective on the myth and reality of Washington and his troops at their winter encampment. Fleming's latest book is George Washington's Secret War, The Hidden History of Valley Forge.
In his Memoirs of Washington, a popular book in the 19th century, the general's step-grandson, George Washington Paul Custis, described a touching scene on the December 19, 1777 march to Valley Forge. When Washington rode to the head of the plodding column, the colonel of the leading regiment ordered his men to halt and present arms to salute the general. As Washington rode slowly past them, he beckoned the colonel to join him. "How comes it, sir," he asked, "that I have tracked the march of your troops by the bloodstains of their feet upon the frozen ground? Were there no shoes in the commissary stores?" The officer replied that when the shoes were issued, the stores became exhausted before his regiment could obtain even the smallest supply. "Poor fellows," Washington exclaimed, and rode on. This encounter never happened. The story is typical of the way 19th century writers dramatized Valley Forge as a place of pathetic misery for the enlisted men, with General Washington and the Continental Congress little more than sympathetic observers of their pain. By December 19, 1777, Washington knew that far more than one unlucky regiment in his army lacked shoes. He had been receiving cries of distress about disintegrating footwear and uniforms for months. As for the army distributing shoes to barefoot regiments, a December 3rd report from the army's warehouses in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, found a smattering of coats, 200, breeches, 30, hats, 50, and a grand total of 90 pairs of shoes. Was America incapable of producing shoes for its soldiers? By no means. The shoe shortage and the food shortage at Valley Forge was caused by the wrong-headed policies of the Continental Congress, which insisted on trying to manage all aspects of running the war without the knowledge or skills to do the job. Another myth of Valley Forge concerns the weather. Too many writers have portrayed the encampment as whipped by freezing winds and raging blizzards 24 hours a day. Fortunately, we have diaries of Valley Forge soldiers who flatly contradict this portrait. Colonel Israel Angel of Rhode Island called January 30, 1778, the pleasantest he ever knew for the time of the year. Bluebirds were chirping in the trees. How should history teachers handle these contradictory stories about Valley Forge? I recommend using both versions. When we examine the legends, we find how they became legendary in the first place. There was a core of truth in the story of Washington's supposed encounter with barefoot soldiers on the Gulf Road. Washington did feel deep sympathy for his suffering men, and they knew it. Similarly, with the weather. It was sometimes very cold at Valley Forge. On January 5, 1778, Lieutenant Colonel John Brooks of the 8th Massachusetts Regiment told a friend that for the previous week the weather had been as cold as I ever knew at home. In early February, a blizzard all but buried the camp and brought the starving army to the edge of mutiny. History, Arthur Schlesinger once wryly remarked, is an argument that never ends. Maybe we can lower the volume on some of the altercations by printing the legends and the truth.
You've been listening to Thomas Fleming, the author of George Washington's Secret War, The Hidden History of Valley Forge. Fleming's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. Talking History's Fiona Beatty joins us to conclude our show with another of her sights of the week, and you'll not be surprised to learn that she has chosen Valley Forge.
Valley Forge holds a special place in the American historical lexicon, evoking images of a bedraggled, starving army triumphing over adversity through the leadership of Washington, discipline, and fortitude. In many ways, the turnabout of the fortunes of the Continental Army is a typically American narrative. No wonder, then, that Valley Forge is a major historical site, both physically and virtually. The website offers a comprehensive virtual visit, beginning in the history section with an overview of the story of Valley Forge. 9 sections offer further exploration of topics, including weather records at Valley Forge, the contributions of Benjamin Franklin to the war, and the spy system in 1777. Click on Who Served and read the biographies and roles played by Benedict Arnold, Nathaniel Greene, Alexander Hamilton, Lafayette, James Monroe, Baron von Steuben, Martha Washington, Mad Anthony Wayne, and others. In addition, there are special reports on the officers, regiments, and surgeons who served. The Frequently Asked Questions section is of particular note and contains scores of answers to questions from schoolchildren and the visiting public, such as the types of diseases rampant at the encampment. The answers are comprehensive. The response to the question regarding disease names the diseases: smallpox, typhoid or typhus, known as putrid fever, pneumonia, and dysentery, and provides supplementary information that most of the troops were inoculated for smallpox at Valley Forge. Those curious to find out if Washington really stood up in his boat crossing the Delaware River will find an excellent example of a teachable moment in action. To read this and much more, go to ushistory.org/Valley Forge.
That's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.